Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jesse Zarley, a host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Alberto Arambor about his new book, Soberanías Fronterizas, Estados y Capital en la Colonización de Patagonia, Argentina y Chile, 1840 hasta 1920, which was published in 2019 by the Universidad Austral de Chile Press. Alberto is an associate professor in the Instituto de Historia y Ciencias Sociales at the Universidad Austral de Chile in Valdivia, where he teaches courses on Latin American and Chilean history. He is a researcher with the IDEAL Research Center, and he currently oversees a four-year Fondesit research project entitled Estado y Mercado en las Fronteras de la Civilización, Historias Transnacionales del Colonialismo Postcolonial in América del Sur. Dr. Arambor is the author of numerous articles, as well as the co-editor with Mario Asada of the diary of 19th century Scottish immigrant William Blaine, entitled Un viaje a las colonias, Memorias y diario de un ovejero escocés en Malvinas, Patagonia y Tierra del Fuego, published by the Centro de Investigaciones Diego Barzarana. Alberto, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jesse. Nice to meet you for the long distance.
you as well. I wonder if you could begin by telling us a little about yourself, where you got your PhD, and what brought you to study Patagonia.
Well, thanks. I did study my PhD at Stony Brook, State University of New York. At Stony Brook by then, they afterwards shortened the title. And I had the pleasure to work there with, well, first of all, with Tom Klubok, who's now at Virginia, with Brooke Larson, and many people. So it was actually a great opportunity for me, coming from Chile, to undertake a transnational approach to state formation in southern Patagonia, which was something that I had explored in my earlier thesis as an undergraduate. When I work on political violence against the labor movement in the 1910s and early 1920s. So when I was an undergraduate at Pontificia Universidad Católica in Santiago, I found that most of the documentation I was looking for ended at the border, but it was a Chilean, you know, authorities. And the documentation ended at the border, but I could see very clearly that most of the people who was portrayed in the documentation, mainly laborers, were very mobile across this border. And also for the owners of the big, very big sheep farming holdings, that they were moving the sheep across this border. So the border didn't exist, but in the documentation. So one of my questions was how to figure out the moment at which this international delimitation was placed on the land and not only in the diplomatic or official documentation, you know?
That's really similar to my own research, kind of thinking about how the border... So turning to the book, in your introduction, you go over how to Europeans and outsiders, Patagonia has been a place of fantasy or mystery, or even considered a damned place, Patagonia Maldita, you use. Until relatively recently, you say that it was also represented as a blank space on a map. So I was wondering if you could situate us and describe a little bit the actual geography and inhabitants of Patagonia before Europeans.
Well, Patagonia is southern Patagonia in this case. I mean mm-hmm. what's currently the provinces of Santa Cruz and Tierra del Fuego on the Argentinian side. If there's something like a side, well, today there's something like a side. And Magallanes in Chile, the southernmost tip of the continent. So there were 4, 5, 6 different peoples or indigenous nations inhabiting the land, some of whom had a long-lasting tradition of commerce, like the Tehuelches or Aonikeng on the continental part of the south, terrestrial and continental. The Tehuelches or Aonikeng centuries-long tradition of isolation, but also of contact. And the main proof is that they were a mounted people, you know. They had horses, but they kind of retreated to the extreme south to keep their autonomy, you know. But they had this very open society, non-hierarchical, which allowed them to incorporate people who came from different backgrounds. You know, a Uruguayan gaucho was cacique in the 1830s in the area of the Strait of Magellan, just to put an example. Thereafter, you have the Selknam, non-mounted, hunter-gatherers in Tierra del Fuego, on the territory of the island, and canoe peoples, 2 or 3 different canoe peoples throughout the very massive archipelago of Western Patagonia. So you had peoples that were in permanent contact between them. The most isolated, I would say, were the Selknam on Tierra del Fuego. But intermixing of cultures there that appear in the literature and the ethnography sometimes confused, and in the most recent literature, since Darwin in the 1830s, late 1830s, they appear like quite different one of and another, you know, but they actually had very good relations, some of them, throughout the time. And that was the moment when Darwin passed through the area and the Admiralty started to do hydrographic prospections, that this area became incorporated into, practically incorporated into the commercial travels coming from Europe, mainly from Great Britain. So what I tried to present in the first chapter is that the fantasy, the long-lasting fantasy about Patagonia, came out of the started with the passing of Hernando de Magallanes or Magellan in 1520. But for 300 years, the area was absolutely out of any commercial circuit. So the peoples there remained fully independent. And that shifted when the steamships began to cross across the Strait of Magellan in the 1840s, following the travels of Darwin and Fitzroy and that. So it was also the moment when, through following the routes of the steamships, the sailing boats went southward through the through Cape Horn. So it was the opportunity that Chile took to try to consolidate a position to claim sovereignty, territorial sovereignty over the area, and that was aiming to help the steamers to cross the strait. You know, that was unuseful up to then.
That's great and super helpful. And I think it's a theme that you developed throughout the book. So I guess another question, turning to that first chapter that you mentioned Darwin, and then you have that great quote from the planetary scientist who compares Patagonia to a Martian landscape. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that process by which in the 19th century, foreign capital and kind of state makers and military minds in Chile and Argentina begin to think of Patagonia less as this kind of imposing place and more as a place of progress, a place where money can be made and that gets integrated into those commercial circuits you described.
Yeah, well, there are a number of circumstances of casualties. Casualidades, how do you say?
Occurrences.
Things happen, you know. And following the opening of this route, a U.S. entrepreneur, William Wheelwright, he began a series of contact with the British consulates throughout the American Pacific for the formation of a company able to provide communication to the British entrepreneurs in Valparaiso, Callao, Panama, the big ports of the American Pacific. This is in the 1830s. So actually they met with Darwin and Fitzroy, probably in Valparaiso, which was an area with very low international commerce, you know. This is in the 1830s, 1840s. And they got the Chilean, the Bolivian, the Peruvian, the Ecuadorian, and also the Colombian government to grant them a series of benefits and subsidies to create this company. They also got, William Wheelwright also got these subsidies in London by the Crown. So they basically built a company out of nothing without any investment. And they, keeping these privileges, they built, which will become the biggest shipping company in the world, the Pacific Steam Navigation Company. And so the Pacific Steam Navigation Company provided this service of communication between London and the South American Pacific ports. And that was the moment when Chile began to figure out that they could actually exert territorial sovereignty on the area. But the foundation of Fuerte Bulnes in 1843 and soon after of Punta Arenas or Sandy Point in 1848 was very disgraceful. Again, for 30, 40 years, the town only was a permanent source of trouble a big expenditure without any commercial production. They basically survived from the rations that were coming from northern Chile. And the Pacific Steam Navigation ships weren't recalling at the small port they had there. And the people, basically soldiers, jailers, and people who was deported there from northern Chile, they basically survived because they were able to establish some commerce with the Aonikenk or Tehuelche peoples on the territory. So the territory lived out of the exportation to Chile, basically, of feathers, guanaco, caps, and that. And it was after the Malvinas, called as the Falkland Islands by the British, that Malvinas was so full of shit that at a certain moment in the late 1860s, they began to move ship to the continent, you know? And that was the moment in the late 1860s, 1870s mainly, that the Chilean governor, a very precarious authority in Punta Arenas, and the Argentinian governor on this very small port of 20, 30 persons living there at the expense of the government, began to bring capitals of British entrepreneurs from Malvinas and to bring the animals too. And so the ship began to expand through the steppes, a través de las estepas. And following the ship, the state began to build itself. So basically the state had no idea, neither the Chilean nor the Argentinian, of what was through these wide distances of Pampa, of southern Pampa. So they granted the land for free or almost for free to British entrepreneurs who brought the ship from Malvinas. And as they expanded, the state authorities began to assert their own power through the transference of official positions to these British entrepreneurs, or mostly British entrepreneurs. And that's what I called, and that's the title of the book, like Borderland Sovereignties, Soberanías Fronterizas. That state and capital and indigenous peoples, and thereafter the laborers coming from everywhere, but mostly from Chiloé, Chilean archipelago. A good number of days of navigation of Patagonia, that these different sovereignties began to build, and mainly state and capital interacted and builded and were building themselves one another, you know? And at the same time, the process of the expansion of the ship and thereafter of the states is what I called the ship sovereignty, you know? Territorial sovereignty for capital, for foreign capitals, and for both states was built after the ship expanded and multiplied through these infinite steps. Something that's more or less the process of the occupation, you know?
I thought that was really an interesting point that you brought up, that that the state remains kind of outside of the process of knowing the physicality and the kind of economic worth of this region, and they find themselves playing catch up to British capital and the kind of sheepocracy that you referred to.
Sheepocracy, yeah, that's a good
And so I guess I'm curious, maybe in chapter two, you talk about how the state kind of plays catch up, and you say it's a three-pronged process by which it's turned into national territory. And you say that it's penal, racial, administrative. So I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about how, how the state plays catch up.
Well, the state, the imagination of the state, I mean, these very distant states who had no cartography of the place or relied on the British cartography, which was also very, very basic and mostly for the coastal areas. But for the interior, they had no idea what was there. Even in the early 20th century. So there were no roads, there were no international delimitation at all. So in Santiago and Buenos Aires, states began to compete each against each other, Argentina against Chile, Chile against Argentina. You know, in both countries it's very significant or very important still. This idea that in Chile that Argentina stole Patagonia to Chile, and in Chile and in Argentina that Chile was stolen a land that had belonged for centuries, you know, to these countries that didn't exist centuries before, but still in the national, in the building of a national idea, Santiago and Buenos Aires competed one against the other. So they envisioned these magnificent plans of Patagonia as a land of redemption for the criminals of the metropolitan areas. That didn't work. Quite the contrary, it produced a number of destructions of the whole city in Punta Arenas a couple of times. There was also this plan for a racial for the importation of European laborers. There were many discussions if it will, who will be best fitted to arrive there, if Germans, Spaniards, Italians, or Norwegians, etc., etc. But it didn't work either, you know. Mainly this area remained as a very distant, unattractive area. And when it became attractive, it was full of big landholdings. These big latifundios comprising millions of hectares. So the attraction was basically for poor laborers from Croatia or Yugoslavia, from Chiloé, from some areas of central Chile or Argentina, but without any hope of getting land, despite the extension of this southern Patagonia. It was quite difficult to get any land because it was very far concentrated by a few brokers working in the name of British capitals. So basically what I tried to show there is that neither the penal colonization, nor this project of building cities, towns, ports, not even this other idea of producing a repopulation through racial profiling of immigrants, it didn't work. I mean, it was the complete laissez-faire of the oligarchic state what allowed for this, what some historians very kindly called liberal policies, you know, of land assignation, that the area was incorporated to the European markets and not to the national realm, but through these authorities that began to exert some power and some control only after the European capitals produced the devastation of the indigenous peoples and native flora and fauna through the introduction of sheep, the only product.
I was wondering maybe to kind of the way you explain the coming together or the kind of overlapping or contradictory sovereignties of capital and the states of Chile and Argentina, you talk a lot about the importance of corruption in building these relations. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you understand corruption and maybe talk about, also explain the process of concesión, the kind of naming of land as state land and then granting it. You in the 1890s, you had a case of the Concesión Grumbín, I believe it is. Maybe you could talk about one of those, corruption and how this land ended up in the hands of these latifundistas.
I mean, it's amazing that there's a lot of historiography on Patagonia. There are a lot of travelers. I'm still discovering in these days some new documents about that. But at a certain moment, I learned of the existence of the memories of a couple of entrepreneurs there. One never published, another one, a very rare edition, a very small edition of the early 1980s. And they are quite, I don't know the expression, they're quite transparent, maybe. They're quite clear about the racial privilege they got only because they were the Europeans who were living in this, which became the metropolis of Patagonia, Punta Arenas. They were living there in the 1870s when a governor went to get some sheep in Malvinas, in the Falklands. And because they were Europeans, the Chilean authority told them to get as much land as they wanted, you know? And they were very few in the town. But they built this network of European-like people who were very poor, the Chilean governor still, and these small merchants. And the governor asked them to get as many land, as good, the better land across the strait, on the coast of the strait, to bring sheep from the Malvinas. And basically the state provided the boat to get the sheep, gave them the land, and at the same time they didn't give anything to the poor immigrants that were coming from Chile as soldiers or small colonists, you know, poor colonists from Valparaíso and Chiloé mainly. So that defined for the, up to these days, you know, a profile in which the weak state authority decided that the better people to give the land, to receive the land, were these merchants, small merchants from Europe, mainly Nogueira and the Brown family, and many others. You know, the book is full of names in that area because the information is quite detailed. And they are also very clear that this connection with local poor, very poor local authorities, precarious authorities, gave them the opportunity in the next years, to establish some contact with the military, with the army, and throughout them to get some exploration of the land, and thereafter to get some contacts in Santiago and in Valparaíso, and to pay the national politicians or to exchange favors with them. For not paying for the land they got for free, you know? And the whole state apparatus by Chile, the Chilean and the Argentinian also, began to work in terms of providing them with the best conditions available to develop the building of a monopoly in terms of sheep farming, commercialization, the port, communications with Santiago, with Valparaíso, with Buenos Aires. So very rapidly, the intricate networks of British capital, plus these local merchants becoming brokers with the Chilean poorest authorities in the area, and thereafter with the national oligarchies, produce a kind of reproduction of the oligarchic state in both Argentina and Chile. And locally, as a marginal area, it was a very rapid expansion. And this expansion caused a policy of genocide against the indigenous peoples once the number of sheep on the continent was so big that they had to expand to this big island southward, inhabited by a number of peoples that had remained up to the late 1880s, independent peoples, without any permanent contact, but with, sporadic contact. So that was the moment in which. And that's the main land grant I have found up to these days in Latin American history. It's the initial one was 1.5 million hectares. But in the next year, it was it reached, I think, something like 4 million hectares. The basis of the Sociedad Explotadora de Tierra del Fuego. And both on the Chilean, because of grants by Chilean authorities, and because of grants by Argentina authorities. So Argentina and Chile were almost at war in their dispute for this stolen land a number of times. But locally, they basically granted the land to British capitals and didn't have any presence in the area for many years.
I had no idea that that was the largest kind of land giveaway in Latin American history.
I haven't found any other biggest. Somebody knows something, please let me know. I think La Forestal probably in northern Argentina. And there's another one in Yucatan, which I know is quite big, but I mean, the Sociedad Explotadora de Tierra del Fuego got finally in the 1910s something like more than 3 million hectares. And they had this, sister company, which is the Sociedad Anónima Importadora and Exportadora de la Patagonia, which worked basically on Argentinian ports. And they had a similar number, you know, and they were basically two families.
Wow. One family.
I mean,
you've kind of developed how sheep and foreign capital came to really dominate this region in many ways at the expense of Chile and Argentina's sovereignty, but also their kind of the wealth, national wealth. In the final chapter, you really get at some of the violence and the kind of heated conflicts in this process. First, over particularly in Tierra del Fuego, the ethnic cleansing and genocide, but we also see class struggle and some kind of, not just kind of your standard class struggle, workers and the bosses or landowners, but also some kind of really complicated conflicts over customs. So the way that the state might gain a little bit of of wealth and revenue from this. So maybe you could talk just, you know, broadly opening up how kind of violence and conflict played out in particularly the early 20th century.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, I'm currently writing something I shouldn't be writing. I'm now in a project working on a comparative approach of colonization companies in the Amazon, Chaco, and Tierra del Fuego. But now I diverted back to Patagonia. And I was seeing new names I didn't have when I wrote the book. The Sociedad Explotadora de Tierra del Fuego was so fast in its expansion and the other sheep farming companies that they conquered, you could say, Santiago and Buenos Aires very rapidly and established networks of corruption. But they built also families. I mean, each one of these families got their sons and daughters married to people from the oligarchy in Santiago and Valparaíso. I mean, these people who had arrived with basically nothing to this out-of-the-world place in the 1860s, in the 1880s, as they were brokers, they made fortunes. And they began to marry their kids, their children, to people in Santiago and Buenos Aires. So when the state, both in Argentina and in Chile, began to discuss the possibility of establishing custom houses in this area, which was quite liberal, to establish some custom houses, they sent these visitors from the north, and the information, the official documentation they reported back was that there was no reason to establish custom houses there, that it would be an impediment to progress and the development of the industry. And, you know, in these days, a couple of days ago, I discovered one of these guys was part of the Chilean custom, main custom officer was actually married and part of this Sociedad Explotadora de Tierra del Fuego. And in the case of Argentina, something quite similar. So all these strategies of nationalization by Argentina and Chile failed in front of the wide networks with politicians and officials and officers in both countries. And on the other hand, they had wiped out the indigenous peoples. In the case of Tierra del Fuego, that's a private genocide. I do not talk much about that in the book, as I concentrated in more inner state capital formation. But more recently, I work on that. And contrary to some versions, that was a private genocide. There's a new book coming out in these days in South Africa, University of Cape Town Press, about private genocides. And there's also this case of Tierra del Fuego, in which British entrepreneurs hired killers to eliminate the whole population that was a menace to the expansion of sheep farming. But in the continent, it was quite different. Anyway, by 1900, you had this big empire of sheep farming connected straight to Liverpool. But they require very few workers. Basically to let the sheep grow after they eliminated the settlement population. And so they began to expand in the area in the late 19, in the very few years, late, in the late few years of the 19th century. they began to build these very big freezing plants. So up to then, they were basically exporting wool. But after the freezing plants, they began to explode also the meat. So they're required to hire hundreds of workers, unskilled workers, most of them, without any right, you know, people coming, migrants to this area with very low population, and where these big landowners were in charge of everything, public and private affairs. So by 1910, you had a kind of explosion of labor demands and the formation of a very active working class, multinational, multi-ethnic, with a high mobility between Chilean and Argentinian towns. And they built this network. The first newspaper they published in Puntarenas, they published the demands of this Federación Obrera de Magallanes, or FOM. They published in English, in Croatian, and in Castilian. You know, so they were really getting into these multinational recent migrants. Very few of them had been born in Patagonia. They were mostly coming from outside, from very far, far away. I mean, these companies owned by British capitals were bringing managers, shepherds from New Zealand, from Scotland, from Australia, South Africa. And the unskilled workers were being brought from Chiloé, Buenos Aires, southern Chile. And this labor movement was very active in the 1910s. So it's kind of the replacement of, you had this very rapid capitalism, state capitalism, being formed in between the late 1870s and the early 20th century. And very rapidly, you had also the replacement, the elimination of the indigenous question and the sudden appearance of the social question with a very active and militant labor movement. And this labor movement, and I think that's the closing of the book, this labor movement was severely repressed between 1919 and 1922. It was destroyed. We have probably thousands of workers that were killed by both, mainly the Argentinian army, but also the Chilean army. And that's a big shift in comparison with the conquest of Tierra del Fuego. The second conquest wasn't private, but was mainly led by the state in support of the landowners. You know, it wasn't the other way as it was in Tierra del Fuego. I mean, in Tierra del Fuego, they were the privates, the landowners who killed, captured, and deported the indigenous peoples. And that allowed the state thereafter to establish on Tierra del Fuego. But in the continent, it was in the late 1910s, early 1920s, that the state undertook the task to eliminate the red menace, you know, this maximalist that were spreading an internationalist language. And that's the moment also, immediately after that heavy repression, that both the Chilean and the Argentinian state began to build their, how do you say, their border controls, you know? It was the first time for two countries that were at the bridge of war a number of times in their dispute for Patagonia. It was the first time that that Chilean and Argentinian troops met at this ill-defined, well-defined in diplomatic terms, but undefined on the ground border. And it was in the prosecution of the strikers, of the labor organizers. It wasn't because they were disputing the land or because the landowners owned land throughout this area, but it was as they were hunting the labor organizers that the Chilean and Argentinian army met face to face, and they were collaborating one with the other.
Wow, that's really fascinating. So I guess for one of my last question about the book is to really kind of take a step back a little to a little bit more of a theoretical level. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more why throughout the book you opt for the term post-colonial colonialism as opposed to settler colonialism. And I'm just curious. I noticed that you have a forthcoming article on that, and I was wondering if you could discuss that.
You're well informed. Yeah, they sent me the copies. No, actually, in this article, I got the final version a couple of days ago. Actually, I reject of the denomination post-colonial colonialism. I think that I was too centered in studying state formation, and I discovered that it was hand on hand with the formation of capital, that I became too concentrated. I mean, you cannot do everything in everywhere, but I think from the perspective of the state, I think the concept was right, post-colonial colonialism. But if you really work on the idea of sovereignty, that's also throughout the book, I should have recognized that that's not a post-colonial setting, but that's a colonial setting. It's post-colonial only in the perspective of the Argentinian and Chilean state that are post-colonial states. But this area, so different, without any significant European or European-American presence before the 1870s, I should have rather used really acknowledging indigenous and social sovereignties. That's a totally colonial setting, you know, settler colonialism. I do use also, not much, but some reflection on settler colonialism, and I think that would be better to understand this area. I think that's a kind of state-centered deformation that I had at the moment I was working on this book.
Not to kind of go too hard on it, but I did appreciate how in using the term you think about it's pushing against the state's imagined ownership or domination over lands that it doesn't possess.
Thank you. No. I mean, I think that's also important in the book, the idea that both the states up to these days did keep an idea that this land belonged to them, you know? I mean, we are about to celebrate, to commemorate the 500 years of the discovery, you know, quote-unquote, of the Strait of Magellan. The most nationalistic approaches are now staging with very wide state support. Not now because of the emergency, you know, but up to 4 months ago, there were a number of activities for the 500 years of the discovery of the strait. And the statement was that Chile and Argentina were actually discovered, you know, in 1520 by the expedition of Magellan. And as you said, you know, that's kind of the naturalization of the ownership, but states that were not even existent by then. You know, countries are not discovered, you know, they are produced, they are built, invented. And so in that sense, thank you. Yeah. In that perspective, the concept tried to highlight the idea that this was a colonial expansion by post-colonial states. Yeah.
Well, Alberto, we've taken a lot of time. I ask everyone one last question. You alluded a little bit to working on colonization companies in a comparative sense, but I was wondering if you could comment on what you're working on these days, either a little more on that project or anything else you have.
Well, thank you. I'm trying to do some work in these days between dividing the time between the home issues in this context of quarantine and Zoom distant classes with the students. This semester I do work with first year student and we are getting in touch through this Zoom platform. So that's a lot of work trying to introduce new students to the study of history in this context. But beyond, I'm working in this project of comparing colonial settings in which state and capital came together to produce a rapid integration into the world market of peoples that had remained out of the reach of both state and capital up to the late 19th century. And in that sense, we hold, that was, I think, the last activity held at the university here in Valdivia. We hold an international conference with people from many parts of Latin America to discuss this age of empire, Latin American colonial processes. And we are working on that in writing a collective book, not a collective book, but an edited book, volume that we hope will come out in next year, early on next year. We'll see how we go through this devastation in this area. And for me, it's quite important that, to keep in touch with the with these colonial settings that I see still in these days are quite compelling. The current situation of genocide in the Amazon refers with many similarities to the rubber boom in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the same that as ship sovereignties were a shifting, a driving force of colonization in late 19th century for the Kanu peoples. In these days in Western Patagonia, the expansion of the salmon industry is equally devastating in many senses. So I think I'll be trying to figure out long continuities of racial, colonial, ethnic profiling in these border areas. I mean, for me, I never considered myself a racist, you know? But going now back through this book, which was written a number of years ago. Now that I've been far more in contact with indigenous people in Patagonia, I do realize the racial implication of many of the assumptions that you can take for granted, or I can take for granted, and I did in this book. I mean, as the this consideration that we were talking about between settler colonialism and post-colonial colonialism. I think that the situation of renewed colonial processes in the Amazon, in Patagonia, in Chaco, allows you to go again back to review your own concepts and categories and ways of conceiving the difference.
That's really wonderful. And it sounds, you know, it sounds like a really excellent process to be engaged in that reflection, as well as the volume that you're working on in the conference that you had in Valdivia. I look forward to hearing more about that. So I want to thank you for being on the show. I really enjoyed our conversation, and take care.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for your questions, for your tolerance to the to the differences, and keep safe.
You as well.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Bye-bye.